Welcome to Wine About History. I'm your host, Max Hamill. And today we are talking about the arguably one of the greatest detectives of all time, Eugène François Vidocq. So he was a criminal, among other things, who became the founder and the director of the Criminal Detection Sûreté Nationale in Paris. That's the first private detective agency in modern history. He's considered to be the father of modern criminology, which he arguably is, the French police department, and he was one of the first private detectives of all time. And today, joining us should have been a bottle of Saint-Nizier 2017 Côte d'Aron. But I drank it all, because it was delicious. It was actually so delicious. It's made by the Delar Frères, the Delar brothers. If they're still around, I want to find them and give them a hug. It was really, really good. I don't have a lot. It's a good Côte d'Aron. It had a... I wish I had taken notes, but it just disappeared over the course of a couple of weeks. It had a very traditional Côte d'Aron flavor, as I remember, a normal profile, a light texture, and it was all around delicious. And I would, if you like Côte d'Arons and just red wines in general, I would definitely get some. Definitely get some. Try it. Write the Frère brothers. Give them some props. But back to Eugène Vidocq. Eugène Vidocq was the inspiration from every detective from Poe's Dupin, how are you considering the pronunciation? See, I cannot even pronounce English words. I'm probably butchering it. And so Poe, which was the first detective novel, arguably, to Sherlock Holmes, was inspired by this man. So he came from a very large, wealthy family. I believe his father was a merchant. I've read different accounts. You know, a lot of sources disagree on that. But his father was wealthy. And he spent his teenage years stealing from his family to provide his living. He would steal the family silver and sell it. And he was, and I quote, fearless, rowdy, cunning, very talented, but also very lazy. He loved to fence. And for those of you who don't know what fencing is, some of you just happened across this podcast, it's the art of sword fighting. Specifically, when we think of fencing, we think of long, thin épée blades, and you tap someone to point. The thing is, people used to carry weapons like that in public, or in Paris was so dangerous they'd carry them in canes, little short swords, long, thin ones. And so this had a real-world application. And he fenced so frequently that he got the nickname the Boar. And that nickname, part of it was from being so aggressive. So his family caught him stealing the silver plates, and his father had him thrown in jail to teach him a lesson. It didn't tame him whatsoever. He stole money from his parents to run to America. But he was conned out of it and was forced to join a traveling circus. I mean, I can't believe the sentence I just read. A young, wealthy merchant's son stole from his parents, tried to run away to America, had the nickname the Boar because he was such a ruthless fencer, got conned out of the money, and joined the circus. Okay. And that's just like his childhood, by the way. It gets weirder. But he left the circus and joined the Bourbon Regiment of the French Army. And he fought against Austria in the Battle of Valmy and Yepes. I believe it's also pronounced Yepes. And he left the army around 1794. He got married. He left her after she cheated on him. And then from around that time to the 1800, he became kind of a wandering con man and thief. He went from escaping from prison to prison. He was very good at fraud. He was good at fraud in the way that a painter can whip up a painting. It is just very easy for him to go out, steal something. And he spent his life from running from one escape attempt to another. And here's an example of that. I mean, really fantastic escape attempts. In the prison of Bicêtre, he waited for months for the transfer from one prison to Brest, where he would row in galleys there. Galleys are ships that have oars. And prison barges are not fun. They're terrible, but that's where he's going to go. And there, an inmate taught him the martial art of sabate, which is, as I said, Paris was very dangerous. Most of the cities back then were dangerous. And what sabate was a French martial art of kicking. It still has a lot of, you know, there's debates about martial arts. I love martial arts. I'm into it a little bit. Sabate has a use because it's just kicking. And what they would do, they even tie the lead weight in their shoes. And your leg has more reach than your arms. You know, it was a real martial art. It's still practiced in France. And they are very, very good at kicking. That's useful because now he can kick his way out of situations. So he tried to escape on October 3rd in 1797 and got stuck in the dungeon for 8 days. You know, that's just the beginning. On November 21st, he was finally sent to Brest, where he would get sent to the galleys. But on February 28th, he escaped dressed as a sailor. A few days later, he was stopped because he didn't have any papers. You're supposed to have papers, proof of who you were back then, kind of like an ID or wallet. They didn't recognize him as an escaped convict. He said his name was Auguste Duval, and while the officials checked his story, he was put into a prison hospital. There, he stunned a nun's habit and escaped pretending to be her. In a town called Cholet, he became a cattle drover. Now, a cattle driver is just someone who helps the cattle along. You've seen them in movies. Get along, little doggies, get along. One of those guys. And then he went through Paris and Arras and Brussels and even Rotterdam, where he was kidnapped by the Dutch as a privateer. So he was shanghaied. And as you don't know, a privateer is someone who's a professional legal pirate employed by the state. He was arrested again and taken to Douai. I don't know how to pronounce that word. D-O-U-A-I. If there are any French listeners, please. Please help me. There he was identified as Vidocq. And then he was transferred to Bagny in Toulon. And then 1799, he escaped again. Actually, no, he was transferred there in 1799. He escaped on March 6, 1800. A prostitute helped him get out. But his father died in 1799. He heard about it. He was heartbroken. He did love his family. I think he was just a wild guy. I mean, keep in mind, he was born in 1775. So he's only been around for about 21 years. In the years of 21, he's been worked in the circus, been a fencer, a thief, a soldier, a savate martial artist, and a privateer, and a fraudster, professional fraudster. So he's definitely a wild one. So in 1809, he was arrested again, just before his 35th birthday. And he made the decision to stop being a criminal. And he said, "Do you want me to work as an informant?" And they accepted his offer, because obviously constantly having to catch this guy was a bit of a headache. So on July 20th in 1809, he was jailed in Bicêtre, where he started working as a spy. And this is a quote from him. "I believe I might have become a perpetual spy. So far was everyone from supposing that any connivance might exist between the agents of the public authority and myself. Even the porters and the keepers were kept ignorant of my mission with which I was entrusted. Adored by thieves, esteemed by the most determined bandits, for even those hardened wretches have a sentiment which they call esteem, I could always rely on their devotion to me." So he spied for 21 months. And then was released with a fake escape. And from that fake escape, he infiltrated the underworld of Paris. And then he created a unit of Sûreté, which were plainclothesmen, that they saw the French police saw the value of that. And they actually altered Napoleonic law for the Sûreté to become a national unit. He hired criminals to work for him as informants, spies, other operatives. He gathered intelligence. he did all these amazing things. Because back then it was, for those of you who don't know, policing back then was pretty much, he did it. You know, the suspicion was enough to get you jailed for something. And in French law at that time, you were guilty until proven innocent. Still to this day in France, you're guilty until proven innocent. He also, this is how he revolutionized it. Instead of just conking people, suspects in the head, and then dragging them off to jail to be waste away, he used information extensively. He spied. He had many near misses as a spy. He also even began to work with forensic science. Now, the government did not like forensic science. The French, they didn't trust at the time. They didn't even know what it was. But they liked his intelligence gathering. So they let him set up, or he rather just probably did it and sent them the bill. He set up a small laboratory in his offices. And there he did all sorts of experiments to try and figure out different ways to solve crime. He also used chemical compounds to test currency, because back then the forgery was a big issue. There were lots of forgers. Anyone with any sort of printing ability and background in printing presses or currency could use it to create forgeries. He also used crime scene investigation extensively, looked into little details. He also used ballistics to solve murders, because for those of you who don't know, back then they had something called cap and balls, which were like blow muzzle loaders. You've seen the movies. They put gunpowder in. They put the wad in. They put the bullet in. They take a stick, ram it down. It's called a ramrod. They pull it out. They shoot it. Well, the rounds were actually standardized. So you could tell the difference between a .58 caliber, a .32 caliber, a .60 caliber round. And he used that to solve crimes. And this is another quote from Vidocq. Was with a troop so small that I had to watch over more than 1,200 pardoned convicts, freed, some from public prisons, other from solitary confinement, put into execution annually from 400 to 500 warrants, as well as from the préfet, as the judicial authorities, to procure information, undertake searches, to obtain the particulars of every description, to make nightly rounds so perpetual and arduous during the winter season, to assist the commissaries of police in their searches or in the execution of search warrants, to explore the various rendezvous in every part, to go into the theaters, the boulevards, the barriers, and other public areas, the haunts of thieves and pickpockets. That's him describing the massive battle he had to do every single day with ruthless criminals in a time period when many people were horribly desperate just to survive. To give you an example of how effective he was, during 1817, he arrested 811 people, 15 assassins, and 38 fences. Fences are people who sell illegal goods. In his years, he personally reduced crime in Paris considerably. He solved many of these cases himself and personally trained his agents. He would dress up in disguises. He would teach his agents how to defend themselves. And he would teach them all how to do this. So this private force to do much more than the police could, because the police were constrained by traditional methods, whereas he was not. And because he was a criminal, could get inside the heads of criminals. But because he was one of them, he was able to revolutionize criminology forever. Now, he was still a wanted man, technically, which is funny, but he was still a wanted man. So in 1817, a petition spearheaded by a police chief, Comte Jules Enjolras, they requested that the king, Louis, not going to bother with telling which Louis because there's so many of them, I gave up. Trying to figure out which one. But King Louis actually pardoned Vidocq. And then in 1820, Vidocq married again to a destitute woman known as Jeanne Victoire Jean. We don't know much about her. People didn't know about her back then either. But she lived with her family. And around this time, Vidocq also befriended the author, Honoré de Balzac. And he used him as a source for many of his novels and figures in his books. And around this time, too, we don't have a lot of knowledge about his marriage life because his work life is so stupendous. But we know that in 1824, she died in a hospital because she'd been sick throughout their marriage. And then 6 weeks later, his mother, Vidocq's mother, died at 80. And she was buried with honors. And she, and then her prayers for her were said in the Notre Dame Cathedral. And around not too far after this, too, Vidocq's superior, police chief Henry, couldn't find a last name, was retired and succeeded by a man named Parisot, who was also kicked out of office, or rather, maybe perhaps shunted to the side, but ambitious and formal were the words I found in sources, Marc Duplessis. Reminds you of the word duplicitous. But it makes you sound like Mark is, from what I've read, Marc Duplessis was a very by-the-book way of doing things, the antithesis of Vidocq's style. And Duplessis would complain about little things all the time. They quarreled constantly. For instance, Vidocq's agents spent a lot of time in brothels and bars and just bad places he didn't want to be. Vidocq said, well, the reason they do this is because they need to meet contacts, gather information, set up operatives inside those places. Duplessis ignored him completely. He did not care. He just wanted things done his way. And Vidocq received official warnings right away. The man who personally decreased crime in Paris was receiving warnings because he wasn't doing things formally enough. So on June 20th, 1827, at 52 years of old, Vidocq handed in his resignation. So at 52, he had done more in one life than most people do in several lifetimes. Now he wrote his memoirs too. He had, and also his income was around 5,000 francs at that point, on top of fees from his personal private investigations. So he became an entrepreneur and a businessman. And he married his cousin, which was not a big deal back then, in Saint-Mandre, in 1830. Now, many of you will think that's horrible. Back then, you married your cousin. It was actually an almost common thing to do. Her name was Floride Manzias. He did this in January 28th of that year. He founded a paper factory, and he employed a lot of convicts there, men and women. This actually led to a scandal, but he reasonably employed the convicts because he knew he could trust them. He was still a hero to them. The company didn't last very long. He went bankrupt in 1831, and then, keep in mind all this time, there's all these revolutions. And the July Revolution caused, you know, that just happened to cause Charles X to abdicate. And so Vidocq, while this is going on, helped solve a burglary around in France at that time, led to the arrest of 8 different people, and the new police chief, I don't know, actually appointed him as head of the chief of Sûreté again. Now, while this is going on as well, So Vidocq failed as a businessman, got a little taste for putting criminals away again. So in 1833, he started Le Bureau de Lausanne. I'm going to butcher this. I'm going to try that again. Le Bureau de Lausanne-Mons. Lausanne-Mons. But it means Office of Information. It was a company of about 11 detectives, a few office clerks and things like that. It was a detective agency and private police force. And it was the first known private detective agency. And again, he did what he did best, hiring ex-convicts, because he knew the best way to catch a crook is with another crook. And once again, he clashed with police forces. He published a few books, and there were a few lawsuits too, and his reputation damages. However, he even tried to get expelled from the city being a former criminal. And then in September 22nd of 1847, his third wife died after 17 years of marriage. He didn't marry again, but being Vidocq, he had a lot of partners. So he, in the 1850s is when he started to decline. He curbed his living. He lived more quietly. He, you know, those bad investments, the paper shop and other things, kind of ruined his livelihood. He had to deal with lawsuits and other problems with his Office of Information. And a lot of people didn't like who he was. He would not obey typical French society at the time. So things would not always go his way. But he survived a bout of cholera when his everyone thought he would die. And he's, but his condition deteriorated until he died on May 11th, 1857 of 81. And he died with his doctor, his lawyer, and his priest, who all missed him. His estate, many people tried to claim it, but he didn't have any children. And he, you know, his stepson tried to even change his last name to get his estate, but there was nothing that didn't really work. So it went to, the assets went to Anne Heloise Leleuf, who had lived in her house at the end of his life. And his, what really endures is not children, not the books he wrote about himself, but his criminology legacy. He did everything that we consider, not everything, but he inspired or got the ball rolling on everything from plaster casts to checking forgeries, ballistics. He even created unalterable bond paper and all sorts of things. So he really was one of the kind of people we always talk about on this show. One of the incredible people that for some reason doesn't get mentioned that much in the history books. So he wrote his own memoir. I suggest you read that. I didn't, because I'm always worried about reading from first-person sources. Who is the subject? Yeah, you know, I'm worried about the bias of the any biography. However, I still read them. And thank you again all for listening. And if you have any suggestions, any requests, any people you think I should look into and do a show about, here's our Twitter page. Go ahead and send me a request on there. And remember, without history, we wouldn't be here.